women's rights, civil rights, and gay rights. In the main, they find such figures as Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Pat Robertson, or Jerry Falwell beneath contempt. Of course, Edsel is correct about the contempt the modern press has for conservatives generally, but it is more than that. It bleeds into open hostility for conservative media institutions such as conservative talk radio and the Fox News Channel, the latter of which does not even claim to be a conservative news outlet, but rather a non-conforming media network that uses the moniker fair and balanced. Moreover, the media's progressive mindset and interpretive approach results in the press calling into question virtually every cultural, traditional, and institutional norm, as one might expect. After all, it now functions as an outgrowth of the broader progressive ideological and political project. It also leads to a more myopic view of society and the evident increasing disdain and intolerance journalists and newsrooms openly display for fellow citizens who may not share their ideological attitudes, especially these days supporters of President Trump. Again, this helps explain the synergy between the press and the Democratic Party. Therefore, it logically follows that the Democratic Party mostly benefits from the media's interpretation of the news. As Gallup reported on April 5, 2017, 62% of U.S. adults say the media has a favorite political party, up from about 50% in past years. Just 27% now say the media favors neither major party. Currently, 77% of Republicans say the media favors one party over the other. In 2003, 59% of Republicans said the same. By comparison, 44% of Democrats now say the media plays favorites, unchanged from the 44% who said so in 2003. Gallup asked those who perceive political bias in the news media to say which party the news media favors. Almost two-thirds, 64%, of those who believe the media favors a political party say it is the Democratic Party. Only about a third as many, 22%, believe the media favors Republicans. This is not new. Americans who perceive media bias have always said the direction of that bias leaned in favor of the Democrats, although the percentage holding that view has varied. For Edsel, the problem is that there are very few good conservative reporters. There are many intellectually impressive conservative advocates and opinion leaders, but the ideology does not seem to make for good journalists. Of course, as the studies demonstrate, there are very few conservative reporters in the first place, given the lack of diverse beliefs and attitudes in newsrooms. And the community of journalists is increasingly cloistered by ideology and geography. But Edsel then makes a self-serving assertion that, in contrast, any examination of the nation's top reporters over the past half century would show that, in the main, liberals do make good journalists in the tradition of objective news coverage. The liberal tilt of the mainstream media is, in this view, a strength, but one that in recent years, amid liberal bias controversies, has been mismanaged. Hence, liberals far outnumber others in news organizations. Liberals are better reporters anyway, and the issue with liberal bias in the media is actually a problem of branding and marketing. Edsel, like Pressman later, must resort to a both self-fulfilling and incoherent formulation of journalism's purpose to justify liberal media bias and simultaneously reject bias as criticism. While the personnel tend to share an ideological worldview, writes Edsel, most have a personal and professional commitment to the objective presentation of information. Edsel's complaint is that the refusal of mainstream media executives to acknowledge the ideological leanings of their staffs has produced a dangerous form of media guilt in which the press leans over so far backward to avoid the charge of left bias that it ends up either neutered or leaning to the right. Furthermore, it seems the media's progressive ideological outlook has in some ways morphed into the moral crusade, as in other societal areas so inflicted with progressive sensibilities during the course of the last century. Kovach and Rosenstiel assert that most journalists sense that journalism is a moral act and know that all of their background and values direct what they will do and not do in producing it. For many journalists, this moral dimension is particularly strong because of what attracted them to the profession in the first place. When they initially became interested in the news, often as adolescents or teenagers, many were drawn to the craft by its most basic elements. Calling attention to inequities in the system, connecting people, creating community. These journalists feel strongly about the moral dimension of their profession because without it, they have so little to help them navigate the gray spaces of ethical decisions. A moral imperative to one's life, let alone career, is certainly noble. It is not exclusive to journalism. It is something to which individuals from all walks of life and all professions and areas of work should possess or strive. But if and when morality is defined by or interpreted through a progressive ideology and related policy and political objectives, the outcome is a profession whose members form a class or aristocracy of strident, pretentious, arrogant, and self-righteously superior individuals, rarely capable of circumspection or improvement. This has most recently and particularly revealed itself in the media's coverage of President Trump. Charles Kessler explains, President Trump exploits that vulnerability with his criticism of fake news. He accuses them not merely of making it up, that is, of getting the facts wrong or concocting facts to fit their bias, but also of inventing the very standards by which to conceal and justify their abuses. The fake authority of objectivity, nonpartisanship, and progress. They are as partisan as journalists were 2 centuries ago, but can't or won't admit it, which means they can't begin to ask how to moderate themselves. In truth, they may be as much self-deluded as deluding. Thus, for many in the press, the president is challenging their moral paramountcy. And herein lies a major part of the problem. What is the prime objective of journalism? Is modern journalism supposed to be a project inculcated with a progressive mindset and value system, yet somehow free of bias, as Professor Pressman argues? Or is modern journalism supposed to be a reporter's pursuit of social activism and a social overhaul, therefore and necessarily an anti-Western reformation, as Professor Rosen demands? Or is it an exclusive club of wise men and women through whom the world is to be explained to the plebs? Or is it supposed to be the gathering and reporting of objective truth and facts where interpretation and analysis are left to the readers, viewers, and listeners? Or is it an institution that should strengthen the civil society by promoting the nation's founding principles? The evidence indicates that when it comes to matters of politics and culture, among other things, journalism has become an overwhelmingly progressive enterprise, and the disingenuousness with which it is mostly denied, defended, or even celebrated, often leads to a pack mentality, groupthink, repetition, and even propaganda presented as news. However, it must be said, as demonstrated earlier, that the attitude of an increasing number of influential media voices is less concerned with the veneer of objectivity and more open about the progressive ideological outlook that motivates their reporting. This is a project that has been underway for about a century. Therefore, the questions raised at the opening of this chapter are more or less answered by the values and mindset of the media's collective progressive ethos and attachment to social activism. Moreover, as foot soldiers for the progressive movement, newsrooms and journalists have also traveled far from the substantive principles and beliefs that animated the early printers, pamphleteers, and newspaper publishers who gave birth to press freedom and American independence. Chapter 2. The Early Patriot Press. A brief examination of the early history of the American press provides critical context for comparison with its contemporary progeny and a standard by which to measure the current state and purpose of freedom of the press. The history of the early press is thoroughly encumbered with the battle for individual liberty and free speech, both essential elements of the American Revolution for Independence. In 1810, Isaiah Thomas, a printer, newspaper publisher, author, and witness to the Revolution, published a seminal 2-volume book, The History of Printing in America, with a biography of printers and an account of newspapers. Thomas was among a very few who preserved the records of the printers during the Revolutionary War period. Thomas wrote that among the first settlers of New England were not only pious but educated men. They emigrated from a country, England, where the press had more license than in other parts of Europe, and they were acquainted with the usefulness of it. As soon as they had made those provisions that were necessary for their existence in this land, their next objects were the establishment of schools and a printing press, the latter of which was not tolerated till many years afterward by the elder colony of Virginia. A printing house was first established in 1638 at Cambridge, Massachusetts. Printing began in 1639. Thomas praises Reverend Mr. Glover for the early printing press in Massachusetts and America generally, Thomas referring to him as a nonconformist minister who left his native country with a determination to settle among his friends who had emigrated to Massachusetts, because in this wilderness he could freely enjoy with them those opinions which were not countenanced by the government and a majority of the people in England. Thus early printing in America mostly related to debates about religion and later promoting the gospel and other books to Native Americans in their language. Thomas wrote that the fathers of Massachusetts kept a watchful eye on the press, and in neither a religious nor civil point of view were they disposed to give it much liberty. Both the civil and ecclesiastical rulers were fearful that if it was not under wholesome restraints, contentions and heresies would arise among the people. In 1662, the government of Massachusetts appointed licensers of the press and afterward, in 1664, passed a law that no printing should be allowed in any town with the jurisdiction except in Cambridge, nor should anything be printed there but what the government permitted through the agency of those persons who were empowered for the purpose. It does not appear that the press in Massachusetts was free from legal restraints till about the year 1755. For several years preceding the year 1730, the government of Massachusetts had been less rigid than formerly, and after that period, no officer is mentioned as having a particular control over the press. Except in Massachusetts, Thomas wrote, no presses were set up in the colonies till near the close of the 17th century. Printing then was performed in Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, and afterward in that city by the same press which in a few years subsequent was removed to New York. The use of types commenced in Virginia about 1681. In 1682, the press was prohibited. In 1709, a press was established at New London in Connecticut, and from this period it was gradually introduced into other colonies. However, the press, that is, the printing of books, pamphlets, newspapers, etc., would become free from license and prior restraint years before the Revolution. Before 1775, printing was confined to the capitals of the colonies, but the war occasioned the dispersion of presses, and many were set up in other towns. After the establishment of our independence by the Peace of 1783, presses multiplied very fast, not only in seaports, but in all the principal inland towns and villages. During the lead-up to and commencement of the Revolution and the eventual victory over Britain, Thomas was most impressed with Benjamin Eddy's, a printer who founded and published the Boston Gazette with John Gill. When the dispute between Great Britain and her colonies assumed a serious aspect, this paper arrested the public attention from the part its able writers took in the cause of liberty and their country, and it gained a very extensive circulation. When the British troops arrived in force in Boston, Eddy's was able to escape, with a press and a few types, and began printing from Watertown. In 1776, Eddy's returned to Boston on the evacuation of the town by the British army. Thomas wrote that no publisher of a newspaper felt a greater interest in the establishment of the independence of the United States than Benjamin Eddy's, and no newspaper was more instrumental in bringing forward this important event than the Boston Gazette. David A. Copeland, professor at Elon University, writes that by 1768, Eddy's and others synthesized all that had happened in terms of the importance of the press. The press, they said, protects the liberties of the people. It keeps government in check. As the voice of the people, the press assures that officials will follow the consent of the governed. Copeland describes how the Gazette declared the following, under the pseudonym Populus. There is nothing so fretting and vexatious, nothing so justly terrible to tyrants and their tools and abettors as a free press. The reason is obvious, namely because it is, as has been very justly observed, the bulwark of the people's liberties. For this reason it is ever watched by those who are forming plans for the destruction of the people's liberties, with an envious and malignant eye. Your press has spoken to us the words of truth. It has pointed to this people, their danger and their remedy. It has set before them liberty and slavery, and with the most persuasive and pungent language conjured them in the name of God and the King, and for the sake of all posterity, to choose liberty and refuse chains. Professor Carol Sue Humphrey of Oklahoma Baptist University explains that historians have long studied and discussed the factors that led to the American Revolution, and they have always given ample credit for the success of the revolt to the press, and particularly the newspapers, for their efforts during the conflict. Even those historians who wrote in the years immediately after the war praised the press for its many contributions to ultimate victory. During the first half of the 19th century, explains Humphrey, historians emphasized the patriotism of the printers in their efforts to help America establish its republican system of government as a model for the rest of the world to follow. These scholars are often classified as nationalist or romantic in their outlook and conclusions. For these historians, the American colonies had an important role to play in making the world a better place to live through the spread of democracy and freedom, and the newspaper served well in helping to bring about the break with Great Britain that led to these developments. Humphrey argues that these historians continually emphasize the importance of the newspapers in bringing on the revolt against British tyranny, and praise the printers for their loyalty and patriotism in the fight for liberty and independence. Indeed, support for independence spread from New England to the rest of the colonies. David Ramsay, one of the first historians of the American Revolution, famously wrote in 1789 that, in establishing American independence, the pen and press had merit equal to that of the sword. In other words, most of the early printers, pamphleteers, and newspapers in the decades leading up to independence encouraged revolution, and they likewise were supportive of the revolution once war broke out. As Ramsay noted, the role of the early pamphleteers and the relatively few newspapers, 40 or fewer by 1775, that existed in the years before the revolution and the commencement of the war, was profound. They were not only sources of information, but far and away provided the philosophical, substantive, and even polemical arguments for the causes and principles that animated the revolution and America's founding. Indeed, in many ways, they fashioned the case for liberty, independence, and representative government. Copeland explains that by the last half of the 1760s, the press had become a partisan tool. Writers regularly proclaimed their rights to a free press. Increasingly, however, the patriots, those in favor of American independence from Great Britain, attempted to silence opposing voices. What seemed to be a contradiction of demands to speak freely for decades, even centuries among Britons, vanished for a time in the colonies. But there was a purpose. It could be found in the ideas of government as proposed by thinkers such as Locke. When Americans won the Revolution and freed themselves from tyranny and oppression, the press resumed its role as a partisan mouthpiece, and most citizens of the new United States adopted the motto, "Freedom of speech is the great bulwark of liberty. They prosper and die together." The groundwork had been set for what would later become the First Amendment to the Constitution. Harvard professor and historian Bernard Bailyn, who has likely studied more of the early pamphlets than any other scholar, asserts that influential in shaping the thought of the revolutionary generation were the ideas and attitudes associated with the writings of Enlightenment rationalism, writings that expressed not simply the rationalism of liberal reform, but that of enlightened conservatism as well. In pamphlet after pamphlet, the American writers cited Locke on natural rights and on the social and governmental contract, Montesquieu and later Delhomme on the character of British liberty and on the institutional requirements for its attainment. The pamphlets, of which there were several hundred between 1750 and 1776, were, Bailyn writes, explicit as well as declarative, and expressive of the beliefs, attitudes, and motivations as well as of the professed goals of those who led and supported the revolution. They confirmed that the revolution was, above all else, an ideological constitutional struggle and not primarily a controversy between social groups undertaken to force changes in the organization of society. It confirmed that intellectual developments in the decades before independence led to a radical idealization and rationalization of the previous century and a half of American experience, and that it was this intimate relationship between revolutionary thought and the circumstances of life in 18th century America that endowed the revolution with its peculiar force and made of it a transforming event. Therefore, while the revolution was undeniably a transforming event, it was not about the fundamental transformation of American civil society itself, as President Barack Obama would proclaim about his own election. Moreover, its purpose and principles were the antithesis of and incompatible with the philosophies that undergird the modern progressive movement, such as those espoused by German philosophers Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel and Karl Marx, and later American progressive intellectuals including Herbert Croly, Woodrow Wilson, John Dewey, and Walter Weyl, among others. Balin makes the critical point that what was essentially involved in the American Revolution was not the disruption of society with all the fear, despair, and hatred that entails, but the realization, the comprehension, and fulfillment of what was taken to be America's destiny in the context of world history. The great social shocks that in the French and Russian revolutions sent the foundation of thousands of individual lives crashing into ruins had taken place in America in the course of the previous century, slowly, silently, almost imperceptibly, not as a sudden avalanche, but as myriads of individual changes and adjustments which had gradually transformed the order of society. By 1763, the great landmarks of European life had faded in their exposure to the open wilderness environment of America. But until the disturbances of the 1760s, these changes had not been seized upon as grounds for a reconsideration of society and politics. By the end of 1776, Americans came to think of themselves as in a special category, uniquely placed by history to capitalize on, to complete and fulfill the promise of man's existence. The changes that had overtaken their provincial societies, they saw, had been good. Elements not of deviance and retrogression, but of betterment and progress, not a lapse into primitivism, but an elevation to a higher plane of political and social life than had ever been reached before. Balin writes, "It was the most creative period in the history of American political thought. Everything that followed assumed and built upon its results." Balin states that the pamphlets published before and during the Revolution and American independence were so important that everything essential to the discussion of those years appeared, if not original, then in reprints in pamphlet form. The treatises, the sermons, the speeches, the exchanges of letters published as pamphlets, even some of the most personal polemics, all contain elements of this great transforming debate. Indeed, Balin writes, expressing vigorous, polemical, and more often than not considered views of the great events of the time, proliferating in chains of personal vituperation and embodying to the world the highly charged sentiments uttered on commemorative occasions, pamphlets appeared year after year and month after month in the crisis of the 1760s and 1770s. More than 400 of them bearing on the Anglo-American controversy were published between 1750 and 1776. Over 1,500 appeared by 1783. One of the great pamphleteers was, of course, Thomas Paine. Although a recent immigrant from Britain, coming to Philadelphia in October 1774, Paine became a decisive voice for American independence. On January 10, 1776, Paine's essay Common Sense was published as a pamphlet. Only 48 pages long and written in plain English, the pamphlet spread throughout the colonies. The Constitution Center points out that it sold an amazing 120,000 copies in its first 3 months, and an estimated 500,000 copies by the end of the Revolution. An estimated 20% of colonists owned a copy of the pamphlet. Numerous newspapers also reprinted it, in whole or part. It is indispensable, therefore, when writing about the press then and now, to examine key elements of this enormously influential pamphlet and the ideas and principles it promoted, contrasted with the ideas and principles of the modern media and the progressive ideology. Common Sense begins with a statement about the distinction between society and government and the latter's limitations in a free society. Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins. Society is produced by our wants, and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by uniting our affections, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. The one encourages intercourse, the other creates distinctions. The first is a patron, the last a punisher. Society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil. In its worst state, an intolerable one. For when we suffer or are exposed to the same miseries by a government, which we might expect in a country without government, Our calamity is heightened by reflecting that we furnish the means by which we suffer. As the colonies increase in population and distance grows between members of society, and as public concerns multiply, a government of representatives small in size and confined in power becomes necessary, writes Paine, to establish a common interest with every part of the community, and they will mutually and naturally support each other. I draw my idea of the form of government from a principle in nature which no act can overturn, that is to say, the more simple any thing is, the less liable it is to be disordered, and the easier repaired when disordered. Paine believed in the primacy of individual liberty. He was hostile to large institutions and averse to taxation and government regulation. For the modern progressive movement and its media voices and scribes, Paine's conception of government is too messy and too dispersed to allow for the required expert decision-making and scientific planning required of a centralized administrative state. Paine then attacks the British monarchy and hereditary succession. There is a greater distinction for which no truly natural or religious reason can be assigned, and that is the distinction of men into kings and subjects. Male and female are the distinctions of nature, good and bad, the distinctions of heaven. But how a race of men came into the world so exalted above the rest, and distinguished like some new species, is worth inquiring into, and whether they are the means of happiness or of misery to mankind. Paine continues, England, since the conquest, hath known some few good monarchs, but groaned beneath as much larger number of bad ones. Yet no man in his senses can say that their claim under William the Conqueror is a very honorable one. A French bastard landing with an armed banditti and establishing himself King of England against the consent of the natives is in plain terms a very paltry, rascally original. It certainly hath no divinity in it. However, it is needless to spend much time in exposing the folly of hereditary right. If there are any so weak as to believe it, let them promiscuously worship the ass and lion, and welcome. I shall neither copy their humility nor disturb their devotion. Of course, the progressive and modern media would agree with Paine's condemnation of monarchy and hereditary succession, but what of the enormous power exercised today by lifetime-appointed judges who micromanage more and more of society? Unelected bureaucrats employed by scores of government departments and agencies who legislate not through elected members of Congress, but by the issuance of untold regulations and rules, and the surrendering of sovereign legal and policy authority to international organizations, thereby conferring governing decisions to organizations that exist outside the Constitution's framework. Is this a Republican design of representative government of which Paine and his fellow countrymen would approve? Yet this is the design and increasing reality of progressive governance. Paine follows with a call to arms for a revolution that had, in fact, already begun in Massachusetts, but had yet to rally all colonists to the cause. Volumes have been written on the subject of the struggle between England and America. Men of all ranks have embarked in the controversy from different motives and with various designs, but all have been ineffectual, and the period of debate is closed. Arms, as a last resource, decide the contest. The appeal was the choice of the king, and the continent has accepted the challenge. 'Tis repugnant to reason, to the universal order of things, to all examples from the former ages, to suppose that this continent can no longer remain subject to any external power. The most sanguine in Britain does not think so. The utmost stretch of human wisdom cannot at this time compass a plan short of separation, which can promise the continent even a year's security. Reconciliation is now a fallacious dream. Nature hath deserted the connection, and art cannot supply her place. For as Milton wisely expresses, never can true reconcilement grow where wounds of deadly hate have pierced so deep. Every quiet method for peace hath been ineffectual. Our prayers have been rejected with disdain, and only tended to convince us that nothing flatters vanity or confirms obstinacy in kings more than repeated petitioning, and nothing hath contributed more than that very measure to make the kings of Europe absolute. Witness Denmark and Sweden, Wherefore, since nothing but blows will do for God's sake, let us come to a final separation, and not leave the next generation to be cutting throats under the violated, unmeaning names of parent and child. The progressive historians were not about to let the early historians write the definitive history of the pamphleteers, printers, and newspaper publishers, despite the fact that the early historians were obviously closest to the actual events. The problem for the progressives was that the early historians tell the story of the Revolution and America's founding, in which the principles and ideas of Western Enlightenment, individual, economic, and political liberty, led to a mass movement, indeed, a revolution. For America's beginning must be either reinterpreted to accommodate the progressive ideological project or denounced as a fraud and a sham perpetrated by self-serving commercial interests. Indeed, as Humphrey examines over time, later historians provided different explanations of American history that parted from the early historians and their patriotic view of the role of the press. For example, she writes that after 1900, progressive historians presented a new interpretation of American history. In an era concerned with inequities and the lack of unity in American society in the 20th century, the progressive historians emphasized the presence of conflict from the initial settlement of the colonies down to the present. Most of the disagreements and arguments occurred between different classes of people or geographic sections of the American colonies, but the Revolutionary era represented a period of both internal and external troubles. Divisions existed both between groups within the colonies and between the colonies and Great Britain. In this environment, the press played an important role in encouraging and carrying out a crusade for change. In pushing for alterations in the relationship between the colonies and Great Britain, the mass media often helped to accentuate the differences and thus helped to make the divisions grow and become worse. But the historical evidence paints a picture of a colonial press that is courageous, vigorous, and openly partisan about America's principles in promoting and defending the cause and arguments for the Revolution, and in fact reflecting the remarkable unity of Americans during the Revolutionary period. Therefore, the colonial press itself is deplored by subsequent progressive historians, not for its activism, but for the wrong kind of activism. Humphrey writes, "With a growing interest in the role of economics in history, more recent progressive historians have questioned the motives for the actions of the revolutionary printers. Several have concluded that most pressmen supported the patriot cause for reasons of economic survival rather than any strong ideological commitment. Hence, for these progressives, the press was part of a self-interested ruse that successfully bamboozled the masses into risking their livelihoods, lifestyles, and even their lives to go to war against the most powerful military force on the planet. But facts are facts, and the fact is, as Humphrey observes, that most Americans concluded that the efforts of patriot newspaper printers to keep readers informed about the war helped ensure ultimate success by boosting people's morale and rallying Americans to the cause until victory was achieved. For the patriots involved in the American Revolution, the weekly news sheets published throughout America were an essential part of the fight. By keeping people informed about the war's progress, newspapers made winning independence possible. Newspapers were essential in the fight to win independence and thus were essential in the creation of the United States." Consequently, the early printers, pamphleteers, and newspaper publishers were truly brave souls. They were patriots, pioneers, and entrepreneurs, both leaders of and reflective of the colonists and their commitment to liberty and revolution. They risked everything to advance and defend an independent nation and civil society based on the ancient truths and observations of Aristotle and later Cicero, among others, the Enlightenment principles and reasoning of John Locke and Montesquieu, among others, and specifically the moral underpinnings of natural law and natural rights, the unalienable rights of the individual, liberty, equal justice, property rights, freedom of speech, and, yes, freedom of the press. In sum, this is the essence of the Declaration of Independence, the formal proclamation of the United Colonies and America's founding. While asserting their own support for freedom of the press, it is difficult to square the modern media's progressivism and social activism with the Declaration's principles, given that every prominent progressive intellectual at the turn of the 20th century denounced the Declaration as an old and stale way of thinking about society, set in a pre-industrialized, largely agrarian culture. thereby emphasizing the individual over the community, personal interests over the general welfare, and limited taxation and government over the government's need to be a dynamic force led by experts in order to better plan and organize society. For similar reasons, the early progressive intellectuals condemned the Constitution's separation of powers and deference to state sovereignty as conflicting with social engineering and collectivism. In understanding the mentality of the modern media, it is crucial to understand the extent to which progressives reject so much of America's early history. For example, in 1907, in a 4th of July address about the Declaration, Woodrow Wilson, a renowned progressive intellectual and historian, then president of Princeton University and future president of the United States, wrote, "It is common to think of the Declaration of Independence as a highly speculative document. But no one can think it so who has read it. It is a strong rhetorical statement of the grievances against the English government. It does indeed open with the assertion that all men are equal and that they have certain inalienable rights, among them the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It asserts that governments were instituted to secure these rights and can derive their just powers only from the consent of the governed. And it solemnly declares that whenever any government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute a new government, laying its foundations on the principles and organizing its powers in such forms as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." But this would not afford a general theory of government to formulate policies upon. No doubt, we are meant to have liberty, but each generation must form its own conception of what liberty is. No doubt, we shall always wish to be given leave to pursue happiness as we will, but we are not yet sure where or by what method we shall find it. That we are free to adjust government to these ends we know, but Mr. Jefferson and his colleagues in the Continental Congress prescribed the law of adjustment for no generations but their own. They left us to say whether we thought the government they had set up was founded on such principles, its power organized in such forms, as seemed to us most likely to affect our safety and happiness. They did not attempt to dictate the aims and objects of any generation but their own. Wilson continued, "So far as the Declaration of Independence was a theoretical document, that is its theory. Do we still hold it? Does the doctrine of the Declaration of Independence still live in our principles of action, in the things we do, in the purposes we applaud, in the measures we approve? It is not a question of piety. We are not bound to adhere to the doctrines held by the signers of the Declaration of Independence. We are as free as they were to make and unmake governments. We are not here to worship men or a document, but neither are we here to indulge in a mere theoretical and uncritical eulogy. Every 4th of July should be a time for examining our standards, our purposes, for determining afresh what principles, what forms of power we think most likely to affect our safety and happiness. That and that alone is the obligation the Declaration lays upon us. It is no fetish, its words lay no compulsion upon the thought of any free man. But it was drawn by men who thought, and it obliges those who receive its benefits to think likewise." Thus the absurdity of the progressive historians in their attempt to hijack and rewrite the history of America's founding becomes clear. More to the point, it can be fairly said that the modern media and most journalists who share this progressive attitude must also reject the principles of their press forefathers, the founders of the free press who urged rebellion against Britain, although they undoubtedly appreciate their wisdom in establishing a free press. But what has become of freedom of the press? Have today's newsrooms and journalists lived up to their purposes? Chapter 3. The Modern Democratic Party Press. Historians write of the party press era, roughly from the 1780s to the 1860s, not long after the founding of the United States. What was the party press era? It was a time when most newspapers aligned themselves with a politician, campaign, or party, and did so openly. As described by California State University Associate Professor Charles L. Ponce de Leon, sparked by divergent plans for the future of the new republic, competing factions emerged within George Washington's administration and Congress, and by the mid-1790s, each faction had established partisan newspapers championing its point of view. These publications were subsidized through patronage, and though they had a limited circulation, the material they published was widely reprinted and discussed, and contributed to the establishment of the nation's first political parties, the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, or Republicans. Ponce de Leon added, "Newspapers like Philip Freneau's National Gazette," writes the most prominent Republican organ, "crafted distinctly partisan lenses through which readers were encouraged to view the world. Specializing in gossip, innuendo, and ad hominem attacks, these newspapers sought to make readers fearful about the intentions of their opponents. The strategy was quite effective at arousing support and mobilizing voters to go to the polls. After all, the fate of the Republic appeared to be at stake." Virginia Tech Associate Professor Jim A. Kuypers explains that the Gazette was anti-Federalist and anti-George Washington, and it had the backing of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson's view was that Freneau merely provided balance to John Fenno's Federalist Gazette of the United States, arguing, "The two papers will show you both sides of our politics." Freneau later infuriated Washington with an editorial titled, "The Funeral of George Washington." That, and his attack on Alexander Hamilton's economic program, left the National Gazette as an unmistakable mouthpiece of Republican views. Jefferson himself was targeted for equally vicious slanders by journalist James T. Callender, who afflicted politicians of all stripes, including Jefferson's bete noir, Alexander Hamilton, and his old friend, John Adams. According to University of Virginia professor Peter Onuff, the 1800 presidential election, which saw Jefferson challenging Adams, reached a level of personal animosity seldom equaled in American politics. The Federalists attacked the 57-year-old Jefferson as a godless Jacobin who would unleash the forces of bloody terror upon the land. With Jefferson as president, so warned one newspaper, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly taught and practiced. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes. Others attack Jefferson's deist beliefs as the views of an infidel who writes aghast the truths of God's words, who makes not even a profession of Christianity, who is without Sabbaths, without the sanctuary, and without so much as a decent external respect for the faith and worship of Christians. "The luckless Adams was ridiculed from two directions," writes Onuff, "by the Hamiltonians within his own party and by the Jeffersonian Republicans from the outside. For example, a private letter in which Hamilton depicted Adams as having great and intrinsic defects in his character was obtained by Aaron Burr and leaked to the national press. It fueled the Republican attack on Adams as a hypocritical fool and tyrant. His opponents also spread the story that Adams had planned to create an American dynasty by the marriage of one of his sons to a daughter of King George III. According to this unsubstantiated story, only the intervention of George Washington, dressed in his revolutionary military uniform, and the threat by Washington to use his sword against his former vice president, had stopped Adams' scheme." But it was the presidential campaign of 1828 between President John Quincy Adams and challenger Andrew Jackson that many consider among the most brutal of the early contests. Once again, the party press was in the thick of it. As described by the Hermitage website, by 1828, Jackson was ready to win the White House. First, he would suffer through a bruising campaign still recognized today as one of the most malicious in American history. Adams' supporters accused Jackson of being a military tyrant who would use the presidency as a springboard for his own Napoleonic ambitions of empire. For proof, they brought out every skeleton in Jackson's closet: his duels and brawls, his execution of troops for desertion, his declaration of martial law in New Orleans, his friendship with Aaron Burr, and his invasions of Spanish Florida in 1814 and 1818. The most painful attack for Jackson by far was that on his and Rachel's character over their marriage. Technically, Rachel was a bigamist and Jackson her partner in it. Adams' supporters thus judged Jackson as morally unfit to hold the nation's highest office. Jackson's allies struck back with attacks on corrupt officials in the Adams administration and labeled Adams an elitist who wanted to increase the size and power of government to benefit the aristocracy. But historian Robert Remini observes that the Jacksonians created a vast nationwide newspaper system. Kuypers explains that at the time that newspapers emerged as a driving force in American political life, they had little to do with objective news. Quite the contrary, they deliberately reported everything with a political slant and were intended to be biased. Nor did they hide their purpose. It was in their names, such as the Arkansas Democrat Gazette or the Arizona Republican. Partisanship was their primary raison d'etre. Editors viewed readers as voters who needed to be guided to appropriate views, then mobilized to vote. In fact, Kuypers asserts, so corrupt was the relationship between the press and Jacksonians that many editors owed their jobs directly and specifically to the Jacksonians. Jackson himself appointed numerous editors to salaried political positions, including many postmasters, while nationally, it is estimated that 50 to 60 editors had been given plum political jobs. Rewarding political friends was nothing new. The Federalists had appointed nearly 1,000 editors to postmaster positions over a 12-year period, but the Jacksonians transformed an ad hoc approach to appointments to a strategic plan. Under such circumstances, few readers of news doubted where a paper stood on a particular position, nor did people think they were receiving objective facts upon which to make reasoned decisions. Historian Harold Holzer describes the impact of party journalism and its power to influence politics and the electorate in the years before the Civil War. By the 1850s, almost no independent voters were left in America, only Democrats and Whigs, most of whom later became Republicans, and nearly all of them avid readers of newspapers. Kept in a perpetual state of political arousal by journalism, and further stimulated by election cycles that drew voters to the polls several times each year, not just on the first Tuesdays of November, the overwhelming majority regarded politics with a fervor that approached religious awakening, evoking interest characteristic of modern sports or entertainment. With only a few notable exceptions, few unaligned newspapers prospered. Sadly, this sounds quite similar to the media environment today. In point of fact, the party press is back, and with a vengeance. Of course, there are certain differences between the party press of old and its present-day incarnation, but there is no denying its reality. While today's editors and journalists are not on the payroll of the post office or other federal departments and are not subsidized by political parties, the revolving door of journalists and/or their family members serving primarily in Democratic administrations, Democratic congressional offices, and Democratic campaigns, and vice versa, is a fact. The evidence of a progressive ideological mindset sympathetic to and supportive of the Democratic Party, in which news is interpreted or analyzed or given context, and where social activism is an essential and overarching framework for reporting, results in writing and broadcasting that mainly conform to the objectives, policies, and principles of the modern Democratic Party and the progressive agenda. Importantly, unlike the early party press era where newspapers lined up fairly evenly behind one party or the other, or one candidate or the other, and transparently proclaimed their partisanship, the current party press also differs in that news outlets are overwhelmingly supportive of the Democratic Party and hostile to the Republican Party, particularly conservatives, and these days virulently antagonistic to President Donald Trump, his supporters, and his policies. Indeed, on January 15, 2018, veteran newsman and columnist Andrew Malcolm summed up the current sad state of American political journalism as so thoroughly and obviously anti-Trump that it has inflamed and balkanized the public. In his opinion piece, titled Media's Anti-Trump Addiction Amps Up the Outrage and Fuels the Public's Suspicion, Malcolm observes that much of today's political journalism has fallen into advocacy, intentionally inflammatory, using or omitting selective details, quotes, and background to make a case against President Donald Trump. The criticism generally centers on something he did or said he would do, or something someone, usually unidentified, said he might do or is considering possibly doing. And then, in a kind of kabuki dance, journalists run to gather reaction from waiting opponents who provide a predictably outraged quote calling for counteraction. When media outlets and journalists conduct themselves this way, they deny Americans a set of generally accepted facts to debate, writes Malcolm. merely providing fodder for an anti-Trump agenda and more argumentative ammo for both sides. The Washington media rightly claimed the duty to check presidential statements. Unfortunately, they couldn't find the time or inclination to apply the same regimen to former President Obama's words as they have imposed on Trump's. Otherwise, Obama would have been called out for the 36 times he promised we could keep our doctor and health plan, the countless specious claims that Al-Qaeda was on the run, the false suggestion that Russia was no longer a strategic competitor, and the laughable claim that his administration experienced no scandal during its 2,922 days. When reporting on a Democratic president and his progressive agenda, the same newsrooms and reporters take a very different approach. That's because, writes Malcolm, the D.C. media, by and large, sympathized with Obama's election and policies. And while the election of an African American was historic, it was not the historically shocking upset that Trump's base delivered to him and us. An upset that far too many political journalists have been unable to digest and have allowed to corrupt their professionalism. Moreover, press reports are filled with headlines and breaking news akin to supermarket tabloids. The public is subjected to daily, if not hourly, hype about news reports and alerts, often based on wishful thinking, speculation, partisan advocacy, anonymous sources, and outright inaccuracies. Virtually anyone with a gripe against President Trump is treated as a newsmaker and repeatedly provided multiple national media formats and platforms to air their criticisms. The list is too long and the examples too numerous to reproduce here, but a few examples will suffice. Porn actress Stormy Daniels and her attorney, Michael Avenatti, who was recently charged with multiple felonies by prosecutors in New York and Los Angeles, became overnight media stars and appeared endlessly on news programs and in news reports. Reality personality Omarosa Ani Manigault Newman, a disgruntled former White House staffer who was removed from her government job, was given numerous media platforms to promote her tell-all book about the Trump White House. Michael Wolff, whose writing was filled with references to anonymous interviews and questionable claims, was given numerous media platforms to promote his tell-all book about the Trump White House. Bob Woodward, whose writing was also filled with references to anonymous interviews, which earned public denials by present and former White House staff, was given numerous media platforms to promote his tell-all book about the Trump White House, and so on. And there is the endless press drumbeat about, or more like cheerleading for, President Trump's imminent demise. As the Free Beacon's Matthew Continetti put it, "The litany has been repeated so often that it's easy to recite. The walls are closing in on Donald Trump. Person X or Y or Z is going to bring him down. It's only a matter of time before he is caught or exposed or loses his base of support and driven from public life." The phrases sound out from our cable channels. We see them in newspaper headlines and in our Twitter timelines. "This time, Trump has gone too far. The end is near. Take that, Drumpf." The press has been campaigning alongside Democratic politicians, officials, consultants, and surrogates for President Trump's impeachment since even before his nomination. Jennifer Harper of the Washington Times has commented that the press mulled the impeachment of President Trump even before he became the Republican nominee for president. That is a rough guide to how long the I-word has been floated before the public. "Could Trump be impeached shortly after he takes office?" asked Politico. "Impeachment is already on the lips of pundits, newspaper editorials, constitutional scholars, and even a few members of Congress." The date of that report was April 17, 2016. Mr. Trump only became the official nominee on July 19th of that year. Journalists continue to bandy about the term with gusto, then posture on camera like it's a foregone conclusion. Many appear convinced that if they package impeachment speculation like fact enough, the American public will believe that the president should be shamed, blamed, defamed, and shown the door. Democrats reinforce the effort with appropriate commentary, even as the persuasive press offers only scanty coverage of Mr. Trump's authentic accomplishments. In fact, on one day, in August 2018, the Media Research Center analyzed an 18-hour period on CNN and MSNBC and found that reporters, anchors, and paid contributors used the word impeachment and credible 222 times. MRC analysts examined all CNN and MSNBC coverage between 6 o'clock a.m. and 11:59 p.m. on August 22nd, counting every use of the word impeach, impeachment, or some permutation thereof. Analysts counted 114 instances of the term on MSNBC and 108 on CNN, for a total of 222 total uses of the word. Now impeachment is reported as a foregone conclusion, with a long line of anti-Trump Democratic members of Congress, college professors, former Watergate prosecutors, never-Trumpers, etc., carefully chosen as news guests and commentators to provide the patina of expert opinion and objective analysis for President Trump's impeachment. There was also nonstop media speculation about, indeed advocacy for, the indictment of President Trump by either the special counsel Robert Mueller or now the United States Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, SDNY, for a laundry list of supposed violations. Might the president be indicted for obstruction of justice resulting from his firing of former FBI Director James Comey, his discussion with Comey about retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, allegations in a discredited dossier funded by the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, a meeting at Trump Tower about which the president was unaware, alleged campaign violations said to result from non-disclosure agreements with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, etc. Of course, two Department of Justice DOJ memoranda, initially dating back to nearly half a century, explicitly provide that the official position of the DOJ is that a sitting president cannot be indicted. The special counsel's office was, and the SDNY is, bound by those memoranda as a matter of DOJ regulation. Therefore, the constant reporting, analysis, and interpretation seems intended by the Democratic Party press to build political and public support for the president's impeachment. Indeed, in the end, Mueller found no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and he did not seek any charges for obstruction of justice. More on this later. But even the tone of the press in reporting on President Trump has reached a level of invective rarely seen in politics. The president is repeatedly referred to or impliedly compared to a fascist dictator, neo-Nazi, white supremacist, racist, Hitler, Stalin, or Mussolini in various news outlets and on media platforms by their journalists, paid commentators, and invited guests. These unhinged and shameful characterizations and rants are so numerous they are easily searchable and profuse on the internet. However, a generous sampling compiled by the Media Research Center is sufficient to prove the point. When Trump goes out there and whips people up, it's like a Mussolini rally, and yes, that's what I said, MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, March 12, 2018. It's our responsibility to call out those times when constitutional norms are being challenged, those times when the President of the United States actually channels Joseph Stalin and calls the media the enemy of the people, MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, March 8, 2018. Donald Trump talks like a racist, thinks like a racist, makes statements like a racist, conjures emotions that give succor and support to white supremacists and white nationalists. He has emboldened white supremacists to come forward. MSNBC political analyst Michael Eric Dyson, July 5, 2018. Our president is a disturbed person, and he's behaving in ways that are simply inexplicable. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, February 21, 2018. The world witnessed a betrayal the likes of which we've never seen. America's president sided with its enemy today. CNN host Chris Cuomo, July 16, 2018. The spirit of what Trump did is clearly treasonous. It's a betrayal of the United States. He threw our U.S. intelligence services, flushed them away, and it came off as being a puppet of Putin. People are going to say there's the taint of treason around this White House. CNN contributor Douglas Brinkley, July 17, 2018. Well, if anybody is issuing demented words of violence and death, I would say it's the President of the United States. I mean, it's quite a pass we've come to when the leadership of a country like Iran seems more stable and rational than the President of the United States. CNN analyst Max Boot, July 23, 2018. We got a guy, Trump, who gets up every morning and excretes the feces of his moral depravity into a nation he has turned into a psychic commode. That's what he's done, and he's a bigot in chief and a racist in residence. Look at this mendacious, relentlessly lying, bigoted, ill-informed person that we have. MSNBC political analyst Michael Eric Dyson, June 4, 2018. I don't think he's, Trump, capable of the basic empathies that we feel as human beings, and that's what a sociopath is. MSNBC guest Donnie Deutsch, March 12, 2018. This is not the party of Lincoln, the party of Nixon, or even the party of Reagan. This is the party of Birth of a Nation film director D.W. Griffith. This is the party of the KKK and the party of Trump. SiriusXM host Karen Hunter on MSNBC's Deadline, February 26, 2018. Article 3 in Section 3 of the Constitution says this: "Treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort." So, no president has ever been charged with treason. Douglas, do you believe the president's actions fall anywhere within that definition? CNN host Don Lemon, July 17, 2018. That is just the emboldening of white bigotry by a white nationalist, white supremacist presidency, and his cronies, and all the other white nationalists that he has empowered. The emboldening of sort of your random white bigots, and then the loosening of the grips on white terrorism in this country, has raised the stakes for all of us. MSNBC guest Jason Johnson, July 29, 2018. What does Putin have on Trump? Has Trump been compromised? All of those people, those experts, those reporters, they are looking at the fact pattern and seeing something strange, even sinister. CNN host Brian Stelter, July 22, 2018. It is astonishing how he, Trump, has become such an effective and destructive virus created by Vladimir Putin. Former Time editor Walter Isaacson, July 23, 2018. He's inciting through mass rallies and constantly lying fervor in a political base. He scapegoats minority populations and affixes blame to them for every problem the country faces. He alleges conspiracies of nefarious forces. This could be straight out of Munich circa 1928. MSNBC contributor Steve Schmidt, June 26, 2018. Under Trump, children are being marched away to showers, just like the Nazis said they were taking people to the showers, and then they never came back. MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, June 15, 2018. Trump's detention centers at the border. I call this a concentration camp for kids because that's exactly what it's turning out to be. MSNBC analyst Michael Steele, June 15, 2018. Trump has very deliberately set up the press as the enemy of the people. You know, this is something that we first heard from Joseph Stalin. This is very dangerous. It undercuts democracy. NBC News correspondent Andrea Mitchell, July 30, 2018. Trump's administration follows the exact pattern that Hitler has. I hate to say it, with the propaganda even down to the Red Cross went into Auschwitz. They cleaned it up for 2 days, it looked fine, they went back, they said everything seems fine there, to quote that new book that just came out, "He is evil. He is evil." MSNBC producer Michelle Reiner, June 24, 2018. Trump is completely detached from reality. People close to him say he is mentally unfit, that people close to him during the campaign told me he had early stages of dementia. MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, November 30, 2017. Donald Trump is a racist. He isn't just a white supremacist, he's a flat-out full racist. Former New York Times reporter David K. Johnston, September 16, 2017. If you vote for Trump, then you, the voter, you, not Donald Trump, are standing at the border like Nazis going, "You here, you here." It's a given. The evilness of Donald Trump. MSNBC guest Donnie Deutsch, June 18, 2018. This whole administration, these guys are terrorists, right? A white nationalist government that will take children hostage to get what they want. MSNBC guest Jason Johnson, June 17, 2018. This is the time for the Democratic base to roar up and say no more of this crap. This is time for vengeance for what happened 2 years ago. MSNBC host Chris Matthews, June 27, 2018. He will be forever remembered as the president who traumatized little children. That's his brand now. He's the president who purposefully traumatized babies and children, and he traumatized them for his political gain or to look like Kim Jong-un. MSNBC host Mika Brzezinski, June 18, 2018. Under Trump, we can imagine a future of jackboots crashing through our doors at 2 a.m., trucks in the streets to take people to the internment camps, bright lights and barking dogs, and worse. Politico chief political columnist Roger Simon, February 1, 2017. Do citizens in dictatorships recognize what's happening right here, right now? Are they looking at the first 2 days of the Trump administration and saying, oh, that's what my leader does? CNN host Brian Stelter, January 22, 2017. Is it time for newsrooms to think of new ways to convey Trump's lack of credibility? Because he says so many things that are bogus. He tells us all these lies. He spreads all these falsehoods. CNN host Brian Stelter, August 26, 2018. Trump's attacks on the American press as enemies of the American people are more treacherous than Richard Nixon's attacks on the press. There's a history of what enemy of the people, that phrase, means as used by dictators and authoritarians, including Stalin, including Hitler. CNN commentator Carl Bernstein, February 19, 2017. Trump is not only not fit to be president. In my book, his lack of empathy, his lack of leadership, his lack of courage, he's unfit to be human. CNN commentator Anna Navarro, August 14, 2017. We haven't had a president this psychologically troubled in this way since at least Richard Nixon. Former CBS News anchor Dan Rather, June 1, 2017. Trump is the chief recruiter and dear leader of a gang of domestic terrorists. The president is the most powerful hate monger in America. He is the imperial wizard of the new white supremacy. He is our first neo-Nazi president.